They say, the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 10:07, Wednesday, May 11th. This is the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. I had my most successful derby in years, guys, because I didn't bet it. I found the secret. And also, John is very disrespectfully wearing a Pittsburgh Penguins shirt today as they're about to eliminate my Rangers in five games tonight.
Well, Joe, hi. Good morning. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent from the Thoroughbred Daily News. I want to know more. How? What are you, un-American, a communist or something? You do a podcast about gambling and handicapping? How the heck didn't you bet the Derby? What's going on here?
Well, once Three Technique won that race in the middle of the card, I said, this is going to happen for me today. So I bet, don't worry. I bet plenty this weekend, just not the Derby.
Yeah.
There you go. Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable. And who would have thought, guys, that an 80-1 win in the Kentucky Derby would be like the least exciting thing to happen to the Kentucky Derby the past 5 years?
Interesting opinion there, John. I want to hear more later on.
Okay. Well, we're going to have an hour and a half to discuss.
All right. That's what this show is for. Did Bill introduce himself?
Yes, I did. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent.
Right. And he immediately went to calling me a communist. I forgot about that. Yeah. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland, home of the world's yearling sale. Make plans to attend the Keeneland September yearling sale beginning Monday, September 12th. Learn more at theworldsyearlingsale.com. So what a derby. We were basically wrong about everything, so we'll start with that. We talked about the derby for over an hour. Did not mention Rich Strike. In our defense, he was on the also eligible list. And in our further defense, he had absolutely no chance to win that race on paper. But it's horse racing. Once they open the gates, they all got four legs and they all can jump up and surprise you or regress and disappoint you. Another thing we were wrong about was the pace. We said all along, not all along, but once the speed horses started defecting from the race, we said it would be a more moderate pace. It was the fastest derby pace in recent memory. I think probably the fastest in the points era. But I want to hear what Bill and John's takeaways were.
Well, where do you start? And Joe, at 80-1, the horse won the Derby, and he was an underlay at 80-1. I totally agree. You know, it happens every 8, 9, 10 years. I mean, it's mine that bird all over again. Now, there are, in hindsight, and obviously, I got to be honest with you, if you would have asked me 2 weeks ago, who is Rich Strike, I wouldn't have any idea. I didn't even know who he was, honestly, because who's paying attention to the horse that finishes third in the Jeff Ruby at Turfway Park. But I think now in hindsight, and this is obvious all in hindsight only, if we had talked about him during the movie, we didn't even talk about it, I would have said he had no chance, save your money, whatever. But three things came together all at once that got this horse to the winner's circle. Number one was, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot about it, the jockey that nobody ever heard of put up one of the greatest rides in Kentucky Derby history. The least likely guy in the race for that to happen. He's the guy who was supposed to screw everything up because he was rides at Mahoning Valley in Belterra Park. That's number one. Number two, obviously the horse improved, and it does happen with three-year-olds at this time of year. Just because they run an 84 buyer on the 1st of April doesn't mean they can't run a 98 on the May 7th because these horses are young. They're improving at all times. And then again, of course, the pace. Usually when you get crazy horses like this to win, it's the result of a pace meltdown. And, you know, he was 17th down the backstretch. It was right where you wanted to be. You didn't even want to be like Epicenter was eighth in the early going. I think most people thought he probably should have been closer. Even eighth was too close to the pace because, the pace was that fast. So the race fell apart. He closed like he was possessed or something in the stretch and got the job done. I do detect, we talk a lot about, what's good for racing and whatnot. I do detect that the public at large, the non-racing public, has kind of gravitated towards this story of the jockey in the winner's circle was adorable with his little girl and his wife and everything like that. And, the horse that wasn't even supposed to win in the Derby and wins at 80-1. So, by and large, it was a feel-good story. And I'll go on record now saying the horse is going to get trounced in the Preakness. And then, we can come back in 2 weeks and say, yeah, Bill, what, look how foolish you are. Now a horse is going to win the Triple Crown.
And just to keep in line with the other Rich Strike facts, because, again, none of us knew who the horse was going into the Derby. You're talking about a horse that not only won the Kentucky Derby, but he was an A other than going into the Kentucky Derby. And not only was an A other than, he was also starter allowance eligible for, at the majority of the racetracks. The only race he ever won in his life was for maiden 30,000. And I will give the owners and the trainer a tremendous amount of credit because, you know, we claim horses. And, you know, if you looked at the horse's PPs going into the September 17th race, he ran once at Ellis Park. And the only thing he beat in that race was the ambulance. He lost, he finished 10th and lost by 15 lengths. And then they dropped him in for maiden 30, you know, at Churchill, which, again, say whatever you want about, oh, Calumet and Joe Sharp really screwed up. That was the right decision at the time. The horse ran a 25 buyer, didn't beat anybody in the race. And the right thing to do was to run for maiden 30. He was 11-1 in that race. It wasn't like he was 8-5 in that race. And contrary to popular belief, because I know that there's a bunch of people out there saying, oh, I went to go claim the horse, or, oh, you know, we were going to claim it. That's all BS. There was one person in for the horse, and thank you for Brian DiDonato for pointing this out. There was only one group that actually went in to claim the horse, and that was the current owners right now. So that was absolutely the right decision. It was a homebred, a modestly homebred for that matter. You know, nobody is clamoring over the fact that Keen Ice is going to be the next great sire of sires, and he's an okay sire, but it wasn't like there was a Curlin himself that was being dropped in, or, you know, or a $500,000 yearling that was being dropped in for maiden 30. It was really, you know, quite a tremendous claim unto itself, even before the horse ran the Kentucky Derby. That being said, Rich Strike the week before the Derby was 24th in points, 24th in points. It wasn't even going to have a sniff of running. And if it wasn't for the fact that the horse was actually training at Churchill Downs that week, he probably still wouldn't be running in the race. You know, he became the second horse in Kentucky Derby history to win out of the 20 post, Big Brown being the other one. And Big Brown was the favorite, you know, in the other one. The horse going into the race, Rich Strike, lost by Epicenter in the Gunrunner Stake by 14 lengths. So he turned that table. And the other thing that I thought was really interesting is the trainer, Eric Reed, had one graded stake win going into the Kentucky Derby in over 9,000 starts. So, you know, again, there's a lot of conspiracy theories out there that, well, maybe the horse, you know, had a little extra something, something. And you know what? If he did, then the guy is playing the ultimate long game, the ultimate long con in his career, because he had 9,000 starts to figure out how to do it the right way and never got it right. And now in the Kentucky Derby. So I'm not too sure, you know, yeah, the horse ran and rebroke down the stretch, you know, and that was a surprise. But you know, when you look at the numbers, and Bill, you alluded to this before, you actually mentioned it, it was the fastest quarter in Kentucky Derby history. It was the second fastest half mile in Kentucky Derby history, but it was the 52nd fastest finish time, which basically meant that it wasn't so much that Rich Strike was pouring it on down the lane and accelerating. He was just decelerating slower than everyone else was. And that was because of the early fractions, and also because a couple of horses that should have been coming down the lane, like Modonical, got in all kinds of traffic problems. And that's what happens in a 20-horse race. Sometimes, you know, you get into traffic issues and you can't get through. So it was just a combination of all these different factors that kind of played into it the right way. You know, Rich Strike was the Villanova versus Georgetown, the David versus the Goliath, however you want to say it. But if they ran that race 99 more times, I don't think that he would have hit the wire first in any of those.
Well, like you guys were saying, it was a great ride because, you know, the horse got steadied slightly once or twice, but he never got his momentum completely stopped, which is a very hard thing to do when you're coming from 17th. The other smart thing he did was coming right out of the gate, left turn. He just said, I want to go to the inside. I want to be close to the rail. I want to save as much ground and just pray and cross my fingers that the pace is going to come back to me. And it did. And I think we were all surprised by how fast the pace was. And, you know, I think that fried horses like Messier and Taba a little bit. But it was a remarkable ride and a remarkable run by Rich Strike, because he could have gotten discouraged and intimidated a lot of times weaving through that pack. And he never did. And he just kept on coming. And it's just one of those things where racing will humble you. Handicapping racing will humble you. This is the most over-handicapped race in the world, the Kentucky Derby. People spend hours and hours and hours trying to we talk about the Derby for 4 months before it actually happened. We've been handicapping the Derby since January, and none of us mentioned this horse one time. And that goes to show you how hard it is, how tough of a challenge it is to handicap horse races, to handicap four-legged animals thinking that they're going to do what you expect them to do coming out of the gate. And it's honestly, it's if you bet the race and you lost a lot of money, I'm sorry. But this was kind of a reminder, I think, for people that you can put all the effort, all of the handicapping into it. And sometimes there will just be results that don't make any sense. And honestly, that's what keeps people coming back. And, you know, that goes for the ownership side of it, too, and the training side of it. You know, everybody was probably looking at them like, what are you doing with this horse? Like John said, he's N1X eligible. He's starter allowance eligible. And here they are in the Kentucky Derby hoping for a scratch. But they took a shot. And I think of last year's Arc with Torquator Tasso, a horse that did not figure on paper. But the connections believed in the horse and they took a shot. And he won the most prestigious race in Europe at over 50-1. So I will never criticize anybody for running a big price long shot in a big race, because why not? You never know what's going to happen. And, you know, it was actually a really good story. Now, besides the fact that someone dug up some old tweets of Eric Reed that were a little problematic. You guys familiar with the milkshake duck viral meme? It was a tweet. I'll read it to you. It's positing this imaginary universe. The whole internet loves milkshake duck, a lovely duck that drinks milkshakes. 5 seconds later, we regret to inform you that the duck is racist. It's like one of these things where someone has like overnight success and everybody loves them, and then someone digs up their old tweets or their old Facebook posts and they immediately have to disavow them. So that was kind of how it was with Eric Reed. But, you know, besides that, it's a good like David versus Goliath story, like you guys were saying. And, you know, I did a couple of TV spots over the weekend, and it was refreshing. It was refreshing to hear people ask and talk about how this injected life into the sport and brought so much new attention to it, because people love it. People love that rags to riches story. You know, they don't want to hear about Bob Baffert, you know, drug positives in the Derby. I don't want to talk about it any more than you guys want to hear about it. And that's to me is what was exciting about this, was that, you know, we all know this stuff about racing, about how unpredictable it is and how anything can happen on any day. But it's great for the general public to see that and maybe wash away some of the bad taste of all the Baffert stuff from the past year.
Yeah, Joe, a couple of points, and getting back to the betting, and, you know, you did the right thing by not betting the Derby. Do you know, have you heard from anyone, I ask both of you this, that made money betting the Derby? I haven't. Oh, for a million. And the reason is, I mean, how could you unless you bet as Epicenter to place or something like that? We'll never find out, but I would love to talk to somebody who hit the for $1, $300,000 superfecta. And I get there's got to be someone out there that lives at 21 Forest Lane and just keyed the 21 on top or something like that.
His name is Richard.
Exactly. Was born on the 21st. I mean, honestly, seriously, you know, $300,000, that's life changing. But how would you possibly come up with that? And that's with the favorite running second in the race. But it unless you're playing numbers or, you know, some crazy theory about maybe all Epicenter or something or other, it's impossible. On our the radio show I do on Sirius XM, we always give a free $50 bet to all our correspondents as a sign of appreciation. The ROI, the return, was zero. That's upwards of 21 people. 0 for 21. But look, it was impossible. John, you're right. I mean, I was talking about Happy Jack was 23-1, which made absolutely no sense because he was probably neck and neck with Rich Stryker, the worst horse in the race. Someone said to me beforehand, this horse isn't going to be that high in the odds as you think, because there are 86 zillion people out there named Jack. They're going to bet on the horse. Yeah, John, maybe, you know, your name is Rich Smith and you live at 21 Windy Hill Lane. I got the $300,000 superfecta, baby.
Sometimes that's all that matters. Sometimes that's exactly why it turns, you know, all this betting on its ear. And guys, the reason why I was saying that like Rich Strike at 80-1 was the least sexy story in the past 5 years. You know, last year we had Mandaloon, being bumped up because of a testing. Authentic was in the COVID year, which the Derby wasn't until October. Country House, you know, technically won the 2019 because there was a DQ in that race, and then Justify winning the Triple Crown and retiring undefeated. I mean, that, you know, those stories, I think, arguably are more important or were more talked about than Rich Strike at 80-1 in the Kentucky Derby. And I think, Bill, it goes back to what you're saying. It's because as much as it was refreshing that a long shot won the Kentucky Derby, the horse is going to be a long shot again in the Preakness, and deservedly so, until proven otherwise. I'm not betting on this horse in the Preakness, which may mean he's going to win, but I wouldn't put Monopoly money on the horse in the Preakness either. The only other takeaway.
You stole my line.
Oh, that's right, Joe. Yeah. Oh, that's right. That's where I heard it from. I knew it was somebody I respected that said it. But you know, the other thing about Rich Strike, two things. One is, Bill, you are forever going to be talking about the fact that the Jeff Ruby stake is still going to be a grade three again next year, or a grade two, because now he has a grade one graduate from the race. So we are going to see the importance of the Jeff Ruby stake again in 2023. But what was your guys' opinion on the whole, like, the horse Rich Strike himself was being such a jerk in the pre-race and in the paddock, and then in the post-race, you know, biting the pony and savaging the rider and everything like that. I think my personal opinion is that, A, the horse is kind of a jerk, and B, the horse only won once before. And I will guarantee you that after that maiden 30 win, there wasn't an outrider pony, you know, right, trying to pull him up and bring him to the winner's circle. So between all these changes that the horse, you know, had to go through over the past week, and even on that day and in that moment, he probably just didn't know what the hell was going on. And when another horse, you know, after winning, he probably felt like he was King Kong, and another horse came over to him, he was probably being like, get the hell away from me. I'm the alpha, and this is what I do. Aside from the fact there were 160,000 streaming fans, on top of it, which, again, I will guarantee you was not the case in all of the horse's seven races combined, the number of people that were there. So, you know, to me, it wasn't great that the horse was savaging and biting and everything like that. But I don't think it was as big of a deal as like what some other people were making it out to be.
Yeah. No, I agree. I feel like people in racing were overreacting to that more than the general public actually cared about it. Nobody asked me any questions about the outrider trying to control him or whatever. But you tell me Donna Brothers didn't pull up on him when he won that 30,000 maiden claimer looking for him? but he's, to the point about the Preakness, he's probably going to be 6, 7, 8 to 1 in the Preakness. Nat Bird, I remember, was like 9 to 2. And that was with Rachel Alexandra in the race. I think Rich Strike is going to be higher than that. And you talk about Mind That Bird. He had better past performances than Rich Strike. I don't even think it was close, honestly. But I kind of, just before we move on to the Oaks, because the Oaks was a big story as well, just wanted to get some thoughts from you guys on the runner-up, the third-place horse, whoever. Because coming down to the 16th pole, it looked like Chad Brown or Steve Asmussen was 99% to get their first Derby win. And that would have been an interesting story in its own right, with Epicenter and Zandon going back and forth. And we'll get to the contest and the results from that as well, because that was a nail biter too. But I just wonder if you guys have any thoughts about the other horses in the race.
Well, you know, they both ran, Epicenter and Zandon both ran winning races. And, you know, 16th of a mile out, okay, who's going to win it, Chad or Steve Asmussen? Then all of a sudden, oh, who's this crazy horse in the red silks? Oh, my God, look who it is. I mean, they ran great, but they didn't have any excuses. I just think that, you know, they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. They, like everyone else, were the victim of this improbable, crazy run by this horse that you couldn't have seen. I mean, you know, as much as we're saying, like, John, you're 6, 7 to 1 in the Preakness, I agree. Would I bet on him in the Preakness? No way. Do I expect him to win the Preakness? Absolutely not. And, you know, he did have a lot going for him. You know, the factors I said about the great ride and the pace meltdown. But nonetheless, he ran a really good race. I mean, his run in the final 16th of a mile was almost to me like a Rossi on the turn in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, where like he's just running in like almost like it seems like he's running twice as fast as everyone else in the field. So, you know, Epicenter and Zandon ran great. You know, there were obviously a lot of disappointments in the race, but most of them, you know, and anybody who was anywhere near that pace early, like, you know, Messier or something like that, forget about it. You know, they were, the minute they put up that 21 and 3, you're looking at, okay, wow, you know, okay, who's going to come from behind and win this? And, you know, oh my God, my horse, I bet on so-and-so and he's sixth right now. That's not good enough. You need to be 16th.
I was going to say, you know, and as far as the Preakness goes, you know, there's going to be a bunch of new shooters coming into the Preakness that either passed on the Derby or like a Thurl Road, you know, that had to scratch at the Derby and Oho didn't make it to the, you know, decided they weren't going to make it to the draw. There's going to be a lot of good, fresh horses in the Preakness, I think, that should make that race really, really exciting. Rattle and Roll, I think, is coming in early voting, you know, Chad Brown's horse. And then Secret Oath, who is going to be migrating, allegedly, is going to be migrating away from running in the, you know, in the Black Eyed Susan to run against the boys again. I think that's going to be a really, really exciting story. But again, I think that if you looked at who ran in the Derby and who's going to, you know, make, you know, some noise in the Preakness, I still go back to Mo Donegal. I still feel like that if he got a better trip and if a horse wasn't, you know, laying on him on the outside for most of down the stretch, he would have come up a little closer. Would he have won? No. Would he finish second? Probably not. But he would have been that much closer. And I have to say that, like, I have not given this horse a lot of love, and that's simplification. But, you know, you look at the horse's past performances, and really, other than his first race of his life, which was on the Tapita, going 5/8, the horse has danced every dance. I mean, he has been there, you know, in the discussion and close to the winner's circle in literally every single race that he's run. You know, not this time out of a Candy Ride mare you think would be able to go that distance. And the horse has done everything that has been asked of it, just has been a little bit unlucky. And again, in the Derby at 35-1, was 15th and was trying to meander through horses, you know, on rush hour traffic and finished fourth. I think those horses are going to be interesting because the way the Preakness is setting up, there could be a pace meltdown in that race also.
Yeah, and I just want to put a ball on this. You know, talking about the race that Rich Strike won, yes, he benefited from the fast pace and a good ride. But if you look at the trackies chart for the race, his peak speed was 44.2 miles an hour, which is super, super fast. Like, you don't see a lot of times like that, especially going a mile and a quarter. The next fastest one was Summer Is Tomorrow, 42.3, when he ran off and set that fast pace. I mean, you want to talk about the final quarter time. Rich Strike, 24.3. Next fastest one in the final quarter was Mo Donegal, 24.82. So that's an entire half second slower in terms of the ground he covered. Only five horses in the race covered more ground than Rich Strike, and it wasn't by a lot. So he earned that. He earned that win. He did get a beneficial setup. He did avoid traffic for the most part. But this was not a fluke win in that everybody fell into his lap. I think that there were plenty of other closers in the race who had those similar chances. And you want to say some of them had, you know, a little bit more encumbered trips. I don't care. He was the best horse in that race for the final half mile. And 80-1 or not, he earned the win.
Yep. And Joe, to that point, like, I don't want to gloss over this. Sonny Leon probably rode the race of his life in that race. I mean, he made three or four decisions throughout the course of the race from the moment the gate opened until all the way around, you know, down the stretch where he was starting to go up the rail and realized that he wasn't going to make that hole and had to shift gears. You mentioned it before. But, I mean, give the guy credit where credit is due. He rode the best race of his life and the most important race of his life. And I know people were saying, oh, well, isn't it great that, you know, that he got to ride the horse in the Kentucky Derby? They really didn't have a choice. The top 19 jockeys in the country were already spoken for. So it pretty much was, okay, let's leave, you know, Sonny Leon on the horse and he knows how to ride him. But he did not ride the horse like it was an 80-1. He did not ride the horse like it was the only mount of his day. I mean, that was the only race he rode at Churchill Downs that day. The night before he was in Ohio riding a $10,000 claiming race. So, you know, you really have to give the guy a ton of credit because he did what needed to be done in the biggest race of his life. And he outrode, you know, arguably the best riders in the country.
Absolutely. And shout out to Katie, our associate producer, who's going to go do a story on him at Belterra Park this week. So we're looking forward to that. And yeah, it just goes to show you, you know, it reminds me of the Baffert thing where everybody automatically sends their good 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds to Bob Baffert. There are plenty of trainers who can get you to the Derby and get you to the Derby winner circle. There are plenty of jockeys who can get you there too. You know, if you win a race, if you win a prep race with like a lesser known jockey, you don't necessarily have to immediately dump that guy and then go to a big name rider. You know, some guys and girls are just waiting for the right opportunity. And Sonny Leon certainly took advantage of his. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. 40 Keeneland sales graduates were showcased in graded stakes at Churchill Downs over Derby weekend, including Derby second and third place finishers Zandon and Epicenter, as well as grade one Churchill Downs stakes winner Jackie's Warrior. Good to see him back in top form. And grade two American Turf stakes winner Stolen Base. Also a reminder that tickets are now on sale for this little pop-up event they got going on in Keeneland in the fall. I don't know if you've heard of it, but the 2022 Breeders' Cup World Championships, the 39th running of the meet, will return to Lexington on November 4th and 5th. You can purchase tickets online at breederscup.com/tickets. We'll be right back with this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Spitestown. Munnings. Echo Town.
It's Echotown for Joe Calamo and Echotown raced away.
And Echotown is drawing away in the stretch. Echotown wins the Allen Jerkin Stakes.
A sire line so prolific, it repeats itself. Echotown.
Congratulations to everybody at Coolmar on the successful return of Jack Christopher in the Grade 2 Pat Day Mile. I'm sure we're going to talk about him as we talk about some of the stellar undercard action from the weekend. The son of Munnings and future Coolmar Stallion stayed undefeated in his third career start. Certainly looks to have an exciting sophomore campaign ahead of him. Bill talked to Chad Brown about his immediate future the other day, so we'll ask him in a little bit. And of course, we got to shout out my boy Cupid on a huge performance by his daughter Desert Dawn, who ran third in the Kentucky Oaks. Really needed her to get second, but she ran great, and she looks like an up-and-coming three-year-old filly for sure. And then on Saturday, Cupid had a 5.5-length winner at Woodbine when Duke of Love got his second career win for trainer Josie Carroll. So shout out to Cupid. Always, always on the rise. So before we wrap the Derby officially, we have to do a little post-mortem on our contest. And just as exciting as the Kentucky Derby was the finish of our contest with Bill and Al neck and neck down the stretch. Al had Zandon and Simplification, who ran third and fourth, but Bill's Epicenter edged out Zandon for second. So the final tally, Bill Finley, 400. Alan Carrasso, 395, then me in third with 234, then John with 215, and Sue with 43 with the leftover horses. So shout out to Bill, the champion.
Now, here's my question. At the end of the Derby last year, I also was on top, but do I get the win, or was Medina Spirit disqualified for purposes of our contest? Because that's how I won last year. So I guess it, but I'm taking credit for it. Yes. No,
Bill, you cannot be held responsible for that. So Bill is the first two-time champion of the Kentucky Derby Fantasy Three-Year-Old Contest. Golf claps all around for Bill. And I think his secret is telling me every year that my team is going to win.
You have the best crew, yes.
You'll have the best one next year for sure, Jeff.
He's already scared. He's already scared of my team for next year. So shout out to Bill. And it's always a great time doing that contest. We got to come up with like a real prize. We can't just have like the virtual crown on Bill's head, as right. fun as that is. I don't know. Maybe we'll buy him Red Sox tickets or something.
They're cheap now.
Yeah, it's a thing.
Yeah.
This year especially.
Is that bad this year? I haven't noticed.
Can we get like a wrestler's belt? You know how they have the belt, and then we can hand it off to whoever's the winner.
So maybe we'll do that. We'll do that for next year's contest. We'll make one of those custom belts like the fantasy football guys do. So congrats to Bill and Al with a great showing, obviously, as well. Just came up 5 points short with Zandon not quite getting past Epicenter for a second. But so let's talk about the Oaks, because we talked for weeks and months about how the Oaks was right up there with the Derby in terms of cachet and in terms of interest. I don't think it really disappointed. You want to say that Kathleen O was a little bit of a no-show. I can agree with that. But everybody else, I thought, ran pretty damn well. I thought Echo Zulu, I called this. Yeah, I didn't make any money on the race, but I called this. I said Echo Zulu could run the best race of her life and run fourth. And that's exactly what she did. She was forced through a fast pace, held on for fourth. She ran great. But Secret Oath was just much the best. Ness ran pretty well. Desert Dawn as well, who I mentioned in the Coolmore spot, I think that she is an up-and-coming three-year-old filly. That would have made my weekend if she had gotten second behind Secret Oath. I got a little bit greedy trying to get one of those long shots into the exacta instead of the try. Should have just stuck with the try. But Secret Oath got a great ride, typically great ride from Luis Saez. Good call switching to him because not many riders are better than him on a day-to-day basis or in big races. And now it looks like she is maybe, possibly, probably going to go to the Preakness. I think that the Derby result aided that decision for Dwayne Lucas that we expect is coming. But what were you guys' impressions from the Oaks?
Yeah, I mean, it was a terrific race. And you know, the big four we're talking about, the only one that snuck in there and beat them, Joe, was your horse, the Cupid Arizona bred, a Desert Dawn. But now, you know, first of all, I don't like to bash line makers, but why was Secret Oath 6-1 in the line? That was crazy there. But, you know, she not only won, she beat a stellar group, and she's really, really good. Now, the story going forward, I don't know why Wayne Lucas is sitting there telling, like, the Pimlico Notes team every day, I haven't made up my mind. Yes, you have, Wayne. You're going to the Preakness. Everybody knows it. I mean, there's no chance. And he should. If the only horse, if Epicenter runs, he will be the favorite in the Preakness. If not, Secret Oath will be the favorite in the Preakness. And it brings back, we talked about the Mind the Bird story. And the second chapter of Mind That Bird was Mind That Bird versus Rachel Alexandra in that Preakness with Rachel Alexander beating him. You'd have virtually the same storyline, a crazy long shot that nobody gave any respect to in the Derby, coming back off a Kentucky Oaks winner who was just, you know, sensational, et cetera. I don't think Secret Oath is as good as Rachel Alexander. I don't know if there's been a filly since she raced that is as good as her, but she's, you know, she's right up there as well. The race, you know, the only way the race could have been better is if you had like the four horses, you know, coming and looking each other in the eye and the eighth pole and somebody pulling it out by a nose. But that was too much to expect. Nest ran great. She just ran into a very, very good horse. She was second. And I do agree, Joe, Kathleen O, who I was a big fan of all along, a little disappointed with her performance, but you know, Secret Oath in the Preakness against Rick Strike and whoever else shows up, you know, that's the storyline next week.
I think this race fulfilled all the hype that we had been expecting and discussing, I should say. And the top four horses, you know, yeah, they finished four of them finished in the top five, which is, you know, which is really, really good. Joe, you were spot on with saying Echo Zulu can run the, you know, her career best and run fourth. And to pat myself on the back, I also said that Kathleen O is getting ready to bounce, and not that fifth place is a bounce, but she certainly didn't run the way that we had hoped that she was going to run. But that being said, you know, once I stop hurting my back by patting ourselves on the back, you know, Secret Oath and Nest also both ran just phenomenal races, and you know, the pace was similar to the Derby in the sense that it fell apart. But at least for the fillies, the top horses are the ones that hit the wire, you know, first and second and, you know, fourth and fifth. I still think that pound for pound, the fillies this year are better than the colts. That's just my opinion. But I really feel like that, you know, to have a horse like Secret Oath who won the Oaks, you know, the way she did, and now she's going to be arguably maybe the first or second choice in the Preakness, again, shows you at the top of the heap that that the fillies are better. And I don't know if Nest, Echo Zulu, Kathleen O, even Shamaha are any, you know, less worthy of being in the Black Eyed Susan. And of course Desert Dawn. I mean, I don't wanna, you know, keep the Arizona Cupid you know, out of the conversation. You know, she was what, 50-1 in the race for a reason, because the top four were just, you know, head and shoulders on paper better than everything else in the race. But I think overall I was really, really excited about the way that the Oaks came out. And part of me wants to see Secret Oath run of the Preakness, but I want a rematch. I want to see those three or four fillies back in the Black Eyed Susan again, you know, going head to head and dueling it out. I'm hoping that this group of fillies are going to be similar to the fillies and mares that we've been watching battle it out, Monomoy Girl and She Dares a Devil and horses of that ilk. And I hope that all of these fillies continue to stay healthy and stay at that grade one level, because it's going to be a really, really exciting spring and summer, you know, around the country if these fillies get to battle each other out at various important grade ones throughout the year.
Well, that's the whole thing. It's like, I don't think it makes any sense to run the Black Eyed Susan, which is a grade two and was at once a really important three-year-old filly race and has decreased in importance over the years. So I think it makes more sense for those top fillies to try the boys now. And then you have all summer to clash in the Coaching Club American Oaks and the Alabama and all those kinds of races. And, you know, we talked to Michael Rapoli last week, and he hinted that he could try Nest in the Belmont. Now, he said that basically it's if she wins, that's probably where we're going to go next. She ran second. Like, she did run well. She didn't win the race. So I don't think that it makes – I think it makes more sense for him to try her in the Belmont, depending on who shows up. You know, you never know who's going to show up. But he's got a really nice filly that I think it's – and I don't want to trash the Black Eyed Susan too much, but I think it's a little beneath her. I think it's a little beneath her and Secret Oath. I think that there are bigger, more worthy challenges for them, at least in the near future. And I agree with you guys. This has the potential to be a great summer and fall with those three-year-old fillies. And then you throw in the mix horses like Latruska and some of the really nice CC, some of the nice, really older fillies and mares that we have. Could be a really, really fun fall with the three-year-old fillies clashing against the older mares, because we're really blessed to have a lot of great fillies and mares racing at the moment. And Bill has talked about this, about how, you know, those are the horses who are sticking around because so many of the colts are getting retired during or after their three-year-old year. And the fillies and mares are the ones that, you know, put asses in the seats as far as racing fans go. You know, just I want to talk a little bit about the undercard, if you guys are good with that, unless you have any other thoughts about the Oaks. Because it was a phenomenal weekend of racing, as we expected. It's always a great weekend of racing at Churchill Downs, the first weekend in May. And there were so many impressive performances that I'm just going to mention a couple, and then I'll toss it to you guys, and then you can throw it back to me. You know, my boy Olympiad, I think he's ready for grade one company, because he looked dead on the turn, man. He looked like he was in deep, deep water, horses on both sides of him, and he just responds and finishes so fast. I can't remember, honestly, the last dirt horse I saw, a two-turn dirt horse at least, who had that kind of finishing kick. He came home in 29 and change again. You just don't see that consistently going two turns. So I think he's ready for grade one company. It sounds like they're going to point towards the Whitney. I think that's smart. I don't think he's quite fast enough. If, you know, Life Is Good and Flight Line and all those monsters show up in the Met Mile, I don't think he's quite fast enough going a mile to tackle those horses. But any two-turn race this summer and fall, I want him at a price if he's going to be anything 3-1 or higher, because he's a total monster. I don't care what his figures say. And the other horse that really jumped out to me was Speak of the Devil in the Distaff Turf Mile. She was absolutely incredible in that race. And she was bought for 2 million euros last year by Peter Brandt at the end of her European season. I don't remember the last time I saw a horse go from last to first that quickly. And it was a slow pace. Her stablemate in Italian was just doing her own thing. Nice and easy on the lead, 24-49. Speak of the Devil was way back there. And as someone who singled her, I thought I was screwed watching that pace and watching where she was. And then the blink of an eye, she was in first, turning for home. And I just, you know, again, 98 buyer, don't care what the figure was. Visually, that was one of the most impressive turns of foot and impressive turf races I've seen from a failure mare in a long, long time. Got to think the Just the Game is next on the Belmont undercard. She is going to be appointment viewing for me going forward, at least. What else stood out to you guys from the weekend?
Well, I've been on the Jack Christopher bandwagon from day one. It's been very disappointed that he didn't make it to the Kentucky Derby. But he came back very strong in the Pat Day Mile. I did talk to Chad Brown yesterday. And, you know, obviously the Triple Crown races are out. He's not going to come back in 2 weeks in the Preakness. And he's not going to go back in the Belmont to go from a mile to a mile and a half. So he's looking at the Woody Stevens. But then his big goal of the year is the Haskell. And, you know, he did it exactly as advertised. I mean, just dominated a pretty decent field in there. He's going to move on to bigger and better things. You know, come if he stays healthy come the end of the year, I do think he's the best three-year-old around, three-year-old colt around. The other one, too, was I didn't like Jackie's Warrior. I really didn't. I didn't like his comeback race one bit in the Count Fleet. I thought that, you know, he was very vulnerable at a very short price, and he really proved me wrong in the Churchill Down Stakes. He was really, really good. And this sets up, look what we might have for the Met Mile. Jackie's Warrior, Flight Line, and Speaker's Corner. Now, you could possibly, I don't think Life Is Good is going to make it. They don't seem to be going anywhere with him right now. But, you know, as good it would be to have him in there. My goodness, what a race that would be if all three go. And I would suspect that that is where all three are looking at. So, you know, that sets up for, you know, a race that, especially if it's one of those clunker Belmonts where, you know, this different horse wins the Derby and Preakness. And then, you know, to the non-racing fan, you know, they're not even going to care or know what the Met Miles, but to the racing people, you know, that could be on Belmont Day, the race that is just, you know, the sizzling event that everybody's looking forward to. So, you know, and also another thing about Jackie's Warrior, you know, I don't have any statistics on this, but, you know, what a credit to the horse. He's now a grade one winner at 2, 3, and 4. Amazing. And, you know, the connections do deserve some credit. They could have retired him and he would have been very much in demand as a stallion. You know, thank you for bringing him back one more year and giving us a chance to see him run again.
Friend of the show, Kirk Robinson. Thanks for bringing him back.
Yep.
Yeah, John.
And Bill, you hit on the two races that I was going to talk about, which is Jackie's Warrior, who just from the moment the gate opened, exploded and took over that grade one, the grade one sprint. And like you said, you know, it's amazing that the horse is a grade one winner at three different distances, at three different ages, and came back with a 105 buyer. So he's really rounding into form right now. I was actually very impressed with the Pathé Mile with Jack Christopher and also with Papa Cap. And I know I'm a homer because, you know, Mark Cassie trains Papa Cap and you know, Mark trains the majority of horses for us. But really, there's a horse that if you watch the race down the stretch, you know, Papa Cap was in front and Jack Christopher looked like he was going by him, like Papa Cap was tied to the rail, you know, and wasn't going anywhere. And Papa Cap did try and to come back, but Jack Christopher was just that much more talented and had that much momentum. But, you know, for me, the undercard race, if you take out the Derby and the Oaks, the undercard race was really the Pathé Mile and Jack Christopher, because not only did he win that race impressively, but guys, he hadn't run since October 2nd. And they brought him back and they didn't bring him back going 6 furlongs or 7 furlongs. They brought him back going a mile, which is, you know, which is really hard for a horse coming off that kind of a layoff. And it did not look like the horse had any rust whatsoever. Chad Brown did a phenomenal job getting the horse ready. And, you know, we talk about Chad and you immediately think of, you know, the graded turf races that he wins every spring and summer and how well he does with the Euros and with horses here on the turf races on the big stage. But here's a horse that is a dirt miler that he is rounding into form. And, you know, you could say that he's doing a great training job on this horse more so than some of the older, more seasoned horses that he has, because I don't think we've gotten to the bottom of Jack Christopher's talent yet.
Yeah, I agree. You know, a lot of those European turf horses, obviously Chad does a great job, but they come to him more ready made than a horse like Jack Christopher, who he really has to work on, especially with that layoff. He did say after the race that he compared him to Ghost Zapper, where I thought that he had a little too much dip on his chip there. So I'm comparing those two, because Ghost Zapper, to me, is one of the greatest horses of the 21st century, at the very least, probably of the last 50 years or so. But he certainly is a super, super talented horse. And I think it makes sense. I think it makes sense if you're not going to wheel him back in 2 weeks in the Preakness to run him in the Woody Stevens, because you don't want to run him a mile and a half. It's going to be interesting to see how far he wants to go, being by Munnings, but I think the end goal has to be the Breeders' Cup Classic, no matter what, with a horse that talented. So thought he ran pretty well. I thought the field wasn't that great, but he did what he was supposed to do. Got a great ride from Jose Ortiz, too. He got him out of trouble, got him with that nice stalking trip in the clear. So definitely a really encouraging performance from him off of a 7-month layoff and off of a fairly significant injury. So we're super looking forward to seeing him next, probably in the Woody Stevens. Just a couple other horses I wanted to mention before we wrap up the weekend. I thought Santin was a big overlay at 7-1 in the Turf Classic. And I think he's a horse who's lightly raced and is moving forward for Brennan Walsh. So he only had a 101 buyer. It wasn't a great Turf Classic field, but I think he's a horse to watch in the Turf division that doesn't really have any standouts right now. So I would keep an eye on him as well. Obligatory, who has that huge monster closing kick, winning the Derby City Distaff. And just her being owned by Judd Monnett reminded me that how happy I was to see Arrogate get the Oaks win with Secret Oath, because obviously he passed too soon, but she's going to carry his flag a little bit. And then a horse I wanted to mention at actually before we move on, Churchill Bleecker Street. She's not super fast on paper, but she's 6 for 6 now, won the Modesty at Churchill Downs. You don't often see horses who are 6 for 6 from the Chad Brown barn never get talked about, but nobody ever mentions Bleecker Street, but she just keeps getting better. Matarea and the 8 Bell has got a really good trip under Flavian Pratt, but she looked good. And then one other horse I wanted to mention from Belmont, who I think might be coming on a little bit, is Cody's Wish. in the Westchester Stakes, got a 104 buyer, son of Curlin for Bill Mott. He was a horse that, you know, kind of, I thought was a little bit of a disappointment last year. He got bet to short prices a lot and didn't really live up to it. But now turning, as he turns to his four-year-old year, I think he's a horse that might be a little bit under the radar and might shake things up a little bit in the mile division. Obviously, it's a stacked division, but I wouldn't throw him out completely if he's a big price in the Met Mile. So terrific weekend of racing. We're going to have a little bit of a lull this week and that week between the Derby and the Preakness, and then it's out of the Preakness, and looking forward to the undercard from that, and then Belmont Day. We are in the thick of it now, boys. It's full speed ahead from here to the Breeders' Cup. The TDN Writers' Room is brought to you by Elaine Zen. Elaine Zen's Stallion of the Week this week is Quality Road. Obviously a monster stallion, has had so much success. This year he's already been represented by Group 1 Saudi Cup winner Emblem Road, as well as Bleecker Street, who I just mentioned a minute or two ago, undefeated in 6 career starts after winning the Modesty over the weekend for Chad Brown and Peter Brandt. Quality Road stands for $150,000 this year at Lane's End, and he's one of those few stallions you could honestly say is a bargain at that price, because he just produces runner after runner after runner. And we'll be right back after this message from Lane's End.
Quality Road, proving Lane's End's tried and true stallion-making tradition, a tradition that leads to success for our partners and our stallions. Quality Road has sired multiple Eclipse Award and Grade 1 winners, including champion 2-year-old colt Corniche, champion 2-year-old filly Caledonia Road, champion 3-year-old filly Abel Tasman, and multiple Grade 1 winner City of Light. He's a leader of his generation. Quality Road, a stallion that stands above the rest.
With some of the fullest fields in the country and quality racing year-round, there's never been a better time to reap the rewards of breeding and racing in Kentucky. Purse money in Kentucky is at an all-time high, as is average purse per race, outpacing California, Florida, and New York. Kentucky breds. Breed them. Raise them. Race them. We all win.
The TDN Writers' Room is brought to you by the Kentucky Thoroughbred Owners and Breeders. Fantastic weekend, as you would expect, for Kentucky Breds at Churchill Downs on Friday. Secret Oath became the 6th Kentucky Bred in a row to win the Kentucky Oaks. On Saturday, all 4 Grade 1 winners from that blockbuster card, Obligatory, Jackie's Warrior, Santon, and Rich Strike, were all bred at Kentucky Calumet Farm. The breeders of Rich Strike earned a $50,000 KBIF registered bonus for the Colts' historic Derby wins. So Kentucky Breds obviously continuing to dominate, and we expect to see that on the rest of the Triple Crown Trail. Now let's get to our Green Group Guest of the Week. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we're beyond thrilled this week to welcome the voice of the Triple Crown and the Breeders' Cup for NBC, Larry Colmus. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Great to be with you guys, and great to have the Kentucky Derby over and done with.
Yeah, it's got to be a little bit of a stress reliever for you, getting all that prep work to get to the Derby. Thought it was a great call, as always. So let's take a listen to Larry's call from the Kentucky Derby. It's obviously a brilliant call, as usual. It might have sounded a little bit of surprised when Rich Strike came up the rail, but I think we were all surprised. So let's take a listen to that.
Down the outside is next. They're coming down to the wire. Epicenter's handed. Rich Strike is coming up on the inside. Oh, my goodness. The longest shot has won the Kentucky Derby. Rich Strike has done it in a stunning, unbelievable upset.
It's obviously a terrific call from Larry. The hardest race to call in the world, but every year he nails it. So Larry, how did that feel?
Well, when Rich Strike made that move on the inside, I wish I had caught him a little bit sooner, but I was glad to catch him at all. And when I said, oh, my goodness, I meant it, because I was as shocked as anybody else.
It was seamless. Honestly, it was a seamless transition. I thought it was great.
Seamless, and it was so organic, Larry. I mean, when you said, wow, a shocker in the Kentucky Derby, that was the best articulated way of saying it, because the rest of us who were watching it around the world were cursing about, holy crap, I can't believe this 80-1 chat was coming down. And I know I heard an interview on Al Michaels when they asked him about the do you believe in miracles call, and he said, no, it was just really off the cuff. You could tell that one was off the cuff for you as well, watching Rich Strike up the rail.
You know, almost everything Kentucky Derby-wise is off the cuff. You know, I'll admit in other races, like when American Pharoah is going for the Triple Crown, and you want the right things to say, you know, be a part of the history of that event. But the Kentucky Derby, there's 20 horses to keep track of. And yeah, there's a few, you know, cyber knife slicing through traffic, you know, stuff like that, that, you know, comes into your head. I didn't have anything for Rich Strike, and I didn't have anything for pretty much any horse in that race, because there's so many possibilities, and you just want to call that race. And when that horse, you know, you just knew when it was Rich Strike, you know, you realize the significance. I mean, this horse wasn't even going to be in this race. You know, all of a sudden he's in this race. He's got to be the longest shot on the board. You know, I wasn't 100% sure of that, but I was, you know, 80% sure of that, you know, because I think there was one other 80-1 shot in there. But he, I mean, I was shocked that it was him, to be honest with you.
I wanted to ask, like, you have, I think you have a very unique calling style, but I imagine, you know, growing up being a young race caller, you pick some other stuff up from some of your influences. Who were some of the guys that, that you looked up to, or you might have emulated a little bit as you were growing up as a race caller?
I think you do naturally get a lot from everybody. You know, you're listening to different people. So when I first was calling races as a kid in Maryland, where I grew up, as a backup announcer in Maryland, I was 18 years old. Marshall Cassidy was calling in New York back then. You know, you had Dave Johnson, that was the voice of the Triple Crown. And then, of course, Tom Durkin comes along and Trevor Denman comes along. And, you know, you hear all these different things. And I think a little bit of everybody gets in your head. And, you know, I think when I first started, when I first was calling, I probably had more Dave Johnson than anybody. And then I got the job at Golden Gate Fields in California, and I probably had more Trevor Denman than anybody. And then more Tom Durkin, listening to him than anybody. And so I think it a mishmash all comes together, and you become you eventually. And, you know, it's like, but it's a natural process. You just let it happen.
Yeah. And Larry, give the audience an idea of when you're going into a race and you're studying it, number one, how you prepare for the race, whether it's the weirdly pronounced names, or, you know, you remember certain silks. And the other question is also, you know, is there a race in particular that you look forward to every year?
Well, as far as the first part of the question, the preparation varies. The Kentucky Derby is its own thing. So in other words, I'll start, like everybody else, watching the prep races from January and start to familiarize myself with those horses. And then when we get to crunch time, you know, within 10 days of the race, Churchill Downs will send me a PDF file of all the jockey silks, and I will make flashcards, and I'll start memorizing the names just 5-6 times a day. That's this horse. That's this horse. That's this horse. Thank goodness I did the also eligibles too, because Rich Strike wasn't one of those 20 horses until the day before. But yeah, that's how you do that. And then of course you've got colors that may be similar in the Derby. So you want to know running styles. You want to know what color the horse is, any facial markings. Do they have a white blaze? Do they not? Do they wear blinkers? You know, anything to separate all those horses in the Derby. Now on a day-to-day basis, you don't have to do that because, you know, you've got 12 horses max. So, and less pressure, you know, your legs aren't shaking and you're not like out of your mind. So on a day-to-day basis, what I'll do is I have an iPad and I will color in all the jockey silks myself. I'll make little, you know, jockey silk photos, sort of, you know, just drawings. And then I'll take a look at that before each race. And then when the horses come on the track, I verify that those colors are right based on the description in the program. And then just look at them on the track until I can go through the entire field and say, okay, I know who they all are, and go from there.
Good on you for being prepared for the also eligibles, because we did a Derby handicapping show last week. We talked about the race for probably an hour and did not mention Rich Strike once the entire time.
You're not the only one.
That's why you are where you are, the preparation. But, you know, so now you're basically, I would say, a part-time race caller. You're doing all the TV stuff, but you're not calling every single day. What are, like, the pros and cons of that? Do you miss being an everyday race caller, or do you prefer it like this?
I miss it. You know, I'd be happy to be doing that on a regular basis. I think it actually would help if I was calling more races with the big races, because you'd be more into the flow of things. In fact, I asked NBC to fly me into Kentucky on Monday so that I could start calling races just by myself up in that booth where I'm going to call the Kentucky Derby starting on Tuesday. So I'm calling these claiming races just, you know, in allowance races just to, you know, get into the flow of things. And, you know, before when I was calling for NYRA, I would start around Wood Memorial Week and I'd have a couple of weeks under my belt to get back into the flow of things. So I do sort of miss that end. But as far as being a day-to-day race caller, yeah, I mean, I love doing it. Things just were weird in New York, whatever. But, you know, hopefully one day the right situation will come along. And until then, I've been, you know, having fun with TVG and doing stuff with them. And, you know, it's been good, you know. So I'm kind of the one thing I don't miss is the trips from the Jersey Shore to the Belmont and Aqueduct, because if anybody's made that commute before, it could be living hell, actually.
indeed.
Exactly. And Larry, when you look at the past performances, it sounds like you do some handicapping in advance just to get an idea of certain styles that horses have, which is wonderful. Are there certain names that you look at and you go, oh, geez, I can't believe I got to pronounce this name again for this horse?
There's a few. It's more like the other way around, where you like to have fun with horses' names. There's certain ones that you enjoy. I remember there's a horse in Florida named Blarp when I was down there, and I always like this Blarp. Have fun with him. But there, I remember one in Jersey, just way too many syllables. The horse's name was Prestidigitation. And by itself, it's okay. But if that horse is at a, you know, battling two other horses in the stretch, and you're just, God knows what comes out of your mouth. So yeah, there's some that they're tougher than others. And a lot of times too, the really plain names like Rich Strike, are the ones that are harder to remember because they're so plain, you know, so they don't stick in your head as much as one with a very unique name.
So if you owned a horse that you could name anything you want, what would you name it?
That's a good question. Something easy to pronounce and easy to remember. So I don't know. I'd probably name him after myself. Well, no, because I'd forget my own name. So no, I wouldn't do that either.
You know, John mentioned how you handicap the races, and I think that's good. That adds to your call is the context. You know, when horses are surprisingly up close or surprisingly far back, do you handicap the races normally? Are you a bettor at all?
I don't normally do much betting. Now, lately, working with TVG, they're having me handicap, which is a new thing, you know, for me. Obviously a fan all my life, so I'm like everybody else, you know, trying to figure out who's going to win these different races. But having to do it on a regular basis now, it's and put in these pick fours and pick fives and trying to hit those things, which isn't the easiest thing. But I think you're always looking for, you know, how you think the race is going to be run, even as, you know, when you're calling it, and you know, what to expect, which horses you know, when they ran 45 and change for a half in the Derby, you knew something was going to be up late. Somebody's going to be coming, and you know, you're prepared for whoever that is going to be, except for Rich Strike, because it couldn't possibly be him, but it was. So, you know, these things happen.
Right. And Larry, when you're sitting there looking at the races, especially for this past weekend, was there a non-Derby race that you were really looking forward to, the Oaks or Jack Christopher winning the Pat Day Mile? Was there one in particular that you were really, you know, that really resonated with you?
Oh, for sure the Oaks, you know, because you had the undefeated fillies in there with these other talented ones. And, you know, you knew it was going to be, something that had to happen because there were so many great fillies in there, and Dee Wayne wins it, you know, and now we get to probably call her in the Preakness, which is going to be pretty exciting. But the other race was, you know, Jackie's Warrior. You know, I think that horse is super talented, and that was a pretty good field. And like you said, the comeback of Jack Christopher. There was, you know, Derby week is full of great races, and you look forward to all of them.
You know, I'm sure there are a couple people on watching this show who aspire to be race callers, or at least have a passion for race calling. Without giving away any of your secrets, what are a couple pieces of advice you might have for someone who's young and coming up and wants to be a race caller?
one of the things now these days is be prepared to wear a bunch of hats, because very few tracks are hiring people just to call races. You know, right. learn how to, you know, be a good writer, learn how to do interviews, learn how to, you know, do television. You know what, that I think all of that's really important. As far as the race calling thing, accuracy is number one. That's the most important thing. Get it right. And don't worry about being too cute. As far as, you know, at first, you know, that's the last thing you want to be doing. You know, don't make it about you. Make it about what's going on the racetrack, and you know, follow the action as best as you can. And I think when you first are starting, I was told this, and that you practice calling these races, and you can't get enough practice, but slow down. Don't try to run with the horses. Just keep it easy. Keep the pace steady. And then, you know, when you get more and more into it and have done it so many times, it just becomes a little bit easier, except when it's the Kentucky Derby, and that never gets easier.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And Larry, I don't have any more questions for you, but I do have a compliment for you. When you were calling the races at Monmouth Park, and we used to run a bunch of horses at Monmouth, it wasn't pre-internet, but it was certainly pre when they were showing the live races on the internet. And I used to ask my wife or my mom to put the phone up to the speaker so I could hear you do the call, and I could picture it in my mind. And to me, that was the best thing that could happen, because the way that you described the races and what was going on, I didn't need to watch it. I could just listen and have a picture in my head. So I wanted to genuinely thank you for doing that for all those years at Monmouth Park.
Well, thank you, because that's to me, that's the ultimate compliment, because that's the job, to call a race for someone who's not watching it. I mean, if that person who isn't able to see the race can picture what's going on, then you've succeeded, I think. And that's what it's all about.
Yeah, I got a second what John said. You know, a lot of times I watch the races on mute, but when you're calling, I make sure to have the sound on. So I hope that's the ultimate compliment.
I usually am the other way around. I mute myself.
just last question for me. You know, one of the things that struck me about watching the Derby on Saturday was how great it was to see the stands packed, to see everybody back and all the energy in the building. Obviously, you're pretty far removed. You're pretty up high. But could you feel that? Could you feel kind of a return to normalcy at the Derby on Saturday?
Yeah. I mean, there were definitely, you know, that buzz that you're used to having. There were some wrinkles to that when Donald Trump showed up and was outside and everybody started turning around and looking up. I'm like, why are they looking up at me? You know, they're looking at Donald Trump. You know, he was like on the fifth floor down there, so I hadn't quite seen that before. But outside of that, there was a lot of buzz to the whole event, and just looking around and not seeing any emptiness, just a sea of people with all these different colors. I'm like, we're back. You know, this is the way it's supposed to be, and there's nothing like it. There's nothing like the Kentucky Derby. You can say any other race that you like better or whatever, but you know, as far as the feel, there's just nothing like it here, at least in the United States. And with that goes the nervous energy that you try to control, because it honestly does affect you. And you know, I do some breathing before, just try to relax, but the palms get sweaty. Even thinking about it now, my palms are getting sweaty again. I mean, it's the Derby's the Derby, and that's all there is to it.
Well, listen, you couldn't tell, honestly, from your calls that you ever get nervous. But, you know, it was a great broadcast on Saturday, and obviously you were a huge part of it. Larry, we love talking to you. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. My pleasure, guys. Anytime.
Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Larry Colmes, receive a free 1-hour tax consultation. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from the Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website worldwide at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you tax.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. The XBTV Workout of the Week this week features Flightline, always appointment viewing, even when he just works out. Worked 5 furlongs in 59 and 1, so he's really ramping it up. That was the second fastest of 54 works at the distance on Sunday at Santa Anita for trainer John Sadler. The son of Tappet has put in 5 works now in the past 2 months. Cannot wait for his return to the starting gate. He's targeting the Met Mile on Belmont Day, which we talked about earlier. And go check out all of Flightline's works because he's always amazing to watch, even when he's just breezing by himself. And I don't know if XBTV could have helped you with Rich Strike. As valuable as a resource as it is, I don't even think the XBTV workouts could have made you find Rich Strike, but they're going to have all the workouts for the Preakness contenders, the Belmont contenders, and like I said, of course, Flightline. So definitely an invaluable resource as this racing season starts to heat up. It's been such a positive program so far today with all the great performances on the racetrack. Now, snap back to reality. We have some trial dates coming up for Jason Service and some of the remaining defendants in the FBI indictments and the federal doping trials. He's the big fish, obviously, that's still remaining. T.D. Thornton reported on this on Monday that he is going to be tried alongside New York-based veterinarian Alexander Chan starting on January 9th. 2023. There are also a couple of other defendants that are going to be tried later this year. The judge, Mary Kay Viscoso, wrote in her May 6th scheduling order, these are firm trial dates. The court will not accept delays. Now, if you remember, there's been a bunch of delays with this trial, some COVID related, some requested by the attorneys. Sounds like we're going to get a conclusion, you know, within the next year or so with the Jason Service thing. Bill knows more about this than me. I'm curious, you know, Jorge Navarro pled guilty. He, you know, basically told the government everything they wanted to hear, sang like a canary, and still got 5 years. What are you expecting for the Jason Service trial and maybe sentencing?
Well, that's a good question, Joe. First of all, what is he thinking? The government is pitching a perfect game here. Everybody who comes before them gets nailed. This Lisa Ginelli got found guilty last week. And, you know, it's obvious. We've all seen this on all the shows that we watch. If you cut a deal, you get less time. Jason, you think Rich Strike didn't have much of a chance to win the Kentucky Derby? Jason, you're not 80 to 1 here, pal. You're 80,000 to 1. If you're watching, Jason, sure, call up your lawyer right now and say, throw in the towel, dude. I mean, so it's interesting you brought that up because there's something that, and I don't have my notes in front of me, but, and again, the whole I'm not a lawyer thing, but there's an interesting thing that hasn't got a lot of attention. Service originally was up for that same misbranding and adulteration charge that they're getting everybody, which is the 5 years. In a superseding indictment, they added in some wire fraud charges, which are up to, if memory serves, right up to 20 years. Could he wind up serving 20 years in prison, which would presumably at his age maybe be the rest of his life? I don't know if he would get 20 years, but he's in line to get a much stiffer sentence than Navarro or anyone else, which again begs the reason. You know, what I mean, again, I guess the man, you know, wants to fight for his freedom and not go to jail. But, you know, now the trial date's set. He's got between now and January. And also, God only knows how much money he spent on his legal defense right now. It's got to be, you know, have a lot of zeros on it. You know, again, I don't understand his direction that he's taking this when it would seem to just go to the government, say, give me, you know, 10 years, give me 7 years, whatever, and I'll plead guilty and I'll tell you everything you want to know. Sounds so much like the way to go. But, you know, maybe that'll happen eventually. But for now, he's going to go to trial and it'll be very, very, it'd be great theater because with Navarro, we didn't get the trial. You know, we never got anything beyond the original indictment and the wiretaps and all the, you know, very juicy stuff that he had, juicy, get it?
No pun intended.
That he had to say in that. You know, we didn't get the next chapters of the story because he pled guilty. You know, from a writing standpoint and a journalist standpoint, I can't wait for the Service trial. I want to be in that courtroom every day and just see and, you know, watch him, you know, and at the end of the day, dude, you're going to be found guilty and you're going to go to jail for a long time. Why not just, you know, right now figure out a way to lessen the damage?
I think what we've been saying from the get-go is that you don't want to be the last man standing in this deal. And right. And I think of the 27 people who are indicted, it's really now Jason is the last bigwig that's still on the docket. And I think he played this hand incorrectly. And Bill, that being said, I think at this point, if he goes to the government and says, you know, it falls on his sword and says, you know, this is what I did, and here, he's got nobody else to kind of rat out. He's got nobody else to turn over.
Good point, John,
at this point. So he almost has to fight it because it's one shot is better than no shot. But I think he mismanaged this. And again, we're not attorneys, but we've been talking about this from the moment that he was indicted, which is the odds are stacked way against you if there's an FBI indictment, number one. And number two, you don't want to be the last guy standing because there's not going to be a chair for you at the end. And that's, I think, exactly where he is right now.
Yeah, I mean, the only explanation I can think of is hubris and thinking I got away with this stuff all this time. I can still beat it. But Jorge Navarro got rid of that hubris ASAP once he saw that plea deal and ended up crying in court and throwing himself at the mercy of the judge. Yeah, that's the only thing I can think of is that Jason Service, you know, has been getting away with this stuff, allegedly, I guess I still have to say, all this time. And he thinks that that's going to be able to continue just from his brilliance or his right. shiftiness or what?
Do you guys think he really, in his heart of hearts, he really thinks he's innocent and that's why he's fighting?
How could he?
No,
how could he?
He knows what he allegedly did.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't make up those wiretaps. They didn't. That's the thing about it. You know, there's no. What is his defense? I was wondering. Like Jorge Navarro's defense. Some of these guys' defense is like, I did bad things, but the other guys are even worse. Kind of like, you know, nobody who's come before the court has even presented any sort of defense or credible defense or anything that you could say. You know, hey, maybe they've got a point. They have no defense. Because it's an open and shut case. They have irrefutable evidence that these guys did this thing. And, you know, again, I'm what on earth is his lawyer going to get up and tell the jury to say this is the reason why Jason Service should be found innocent? I couldn't even begin to imagine what that line of defense is going to be.
Unless they come in and say, you know, what we were using wasn't performance enhancing, so our guy got duped also. He basically paid for snake oil and for expensive, you know, for the horses to pee out expensive urine. It didn't help the horses, so therefore he shouldn't be, you know, the misbranding should be kind of thrown out. I think that's not even plausible, but I'm just saying, like, is that a defense? And maybe that's why
maybe you're right. But it doesn't matter. I mean, there's nothing that says like, okay, you bought the stuff and you didn't really know how bad it doesn't matter. You know?
Yeah.
But you're right. Maybe that's their Hail Mary. I don't know.
It is. It really is their, I mean, we've been talking about this ad nauseum. I can't imagine that he's got any kind of a defense, but it's going to have to be something really outrageously creative. Because they haven't dead the rights, it seems like.
I mean, the 48% win percentage off the claim would seem to suggest that he had the good stuff. So
that was good placement. That was good placement.
West Point had a busy Derby weekend with several runners at Churchill Downs. They're always, always in action on these big racing days. We have some pictures that we'll show of their visits to the backside and in the paddock. Looks like everyone had a great time. And West Point has two entries to watch on Thursday. A long, long time ago, we'll be running at Belmont Park for Steve Asmussen, and Brigadier General will be at Churchill with Dallas Stewart. So good luck to all the partners and hope you guys really enjoyed Derby weekend. And I know you're all looking forward to Flightline coming back in the Met Mile. We're counting down the days. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse. Every step of the way, when it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Ocala stud sire Gervin had his first winner last week at Churchill Downs. Gervin was a Legacy grad back in 2015 when he sold for $130,000 at the Facing Tipton October sale before going on to win several graded stakes, including the 2017 Grade 1 Haskell Stakes. And we're just around the corner from the yearling sale, so definitely hit up Tommy or Wendy. You've got a great clearance rate, small business operation, but they do a great job and they compete with the big consignments. So definitely hit up Tommy or Wendy as that yearling sale season approaches. So it's been a great episode. Great to talk about the Derby with you guys and great to tip the hat to Bill for an exciting, exciting win in the Derby contest. And of course, Remy has a little bit of a take on this year's Derby. And, you know, I think this is kind of what we all thought was even Hollywood would toss this story from Rich Strike. It's just a ridiculous, implausible story, considering all of the things that were against him and all of the background information on him. And this executive says, "We'll pass. To be honest, your story's hard to believe, even for us. Hard to argue with that." All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland, home of the world's yearling sale. Make plans to attend the Keeneland September yearling sale beginning Monday, September 12th. Learn more at theworldsyearlingsale.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, diehard Pittsburgh Penguins fan John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Larry Colmus, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. See you next week.